Welcome to today's deep dive. You know, usually we think of our past as this fixed historical record.
Right, like it's just a filing cabinet.
Exactly. You lived it, you survived it, and there it sits in the filing cabinet of your mind. But today, we're actually unpacking a pretty wild contradiction about how we view our own history. We're doing a deep dive based entirely on Chapter 12 of Jax Bercow's book, Laws of Life, Book 2. Now build this system for your life.
And this chapter flips that whole script entirely.
It really does. The chapter is titled, Your Past Isn't a Liability Unless You Make It One. And the mission today is to explore the core law here, which is that, yeah, the past is a fixed entity, but the meaning you assign to it and the actions you build from it, those are choices you make today.
It's a profound premise, honestly, especially when you look at it through the lens of, well, history and public narrative.
Which is exactly what you do.
Right. As a researcher studying biographies and how leaders kind of shape their public lives, I constantly see the mechanics behind how people use their histories. And Spirko opens the chapter by highlighting this massive psychological paradox.
Yeah, the contrast is just wild.
It is. Everyday people, you know, they often treat real difficult pasts as an ironclad excuse for why they are stuck in life. But then on the public stage, you see the exact opposite.
You really do.
Public figures frequently fabricate or embellish traumatic pasts just to make themselves look better.
And I'll be honest, I struggle with this premise initially.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a trauma-informed performance coach, I spend my days helping adults untangle their hardest experiences to find some semblance of, you know, disciplined growth.
Right. You're seeing the real thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I see the devastation of real trauma every single day. So it is really hard for me to wrap my head around someone willfully inventing trauma just for clout. Like, is it purely sociopathic behavior or is there some deeper societal reward system driving this?
Oh, it is absolutely a societal reward system. I mean, throughout history, surviving a crucible has always granted this instant, unassailable credibility.
It's the hero's journey.
Exactly. If a leader stands up and says, hey, I was handed everything and succeeded, we feel nothing. But if they say, I crawled through broken glass and succeeded, suddenly we want to follow them. And Spirko details several modern examples to show just how pervasive this myth-making really is.
Yeah, let's talk about those, because the media examples are crazy.
They are. You have Brian Williams, right? He basically borrowed the credibility of combat veterans by falsely claiming his helicopter was shot down in Iraq.
Which is just wow.
Or James Frey. He invented all these horrifying experiences with addiction and jail time for his book, A Million Little Pieces, before he was eventually exposed.
Oprah confronted him on that.
She did, yeah. And then Somali Mom, she built international fame as an anti-trafficking activist by fabricating a backstory of being sold into sexual slavery. And Greg Mortensen claimed a false Taliban kidnapping to sell his book, Three Cups of Tea.
It's just a pattern.
It is. And they didn't invent these stories because they were mentally ill. They invented them because the market demands a hero who has suffered.
And Spirko proves this isn't just an anomaly in publishing or entertainment, right?
Yeah.
It's practically a political strategy. And I think it's really important to point out to everyone listening that Spirko explicitly uses these examples to show it is a universal nonpartisan phenomenon. He specifically chooses two Republicans and two Democrats to illustrate the point.
Precisely. It's a completely bipartisan tactic. For example, you have Dr. Ben Carson, who wrote about trying to stab a friend as a teen.
Oh, right. The belt buckle story.
Yeah. He claimed the blade broke on a belt buckle. It was this manufactured moment of extreme hardship just to make his redemption arc more dramatic. And then there's the famous bread bags saga.
I remember this one.
Joni Ernst popularized a story about being so poor she wore bread bags on her shoes. But it was quickly pointed out that this was just a totally normal, practical workaround to keep your boots dry in a Midwest winter. It wasn't a sign of abject poverty at all.
Which is funny enough on its own. But then Amy Klobuchar used the exact same bread bag story in a primary debate.
Right.
Despite having a very comfortable suburban upbringing with two professional parents, she basically tried to frame a standard childhood as this gritty hardship.
And it goes even further, almost into stolen valor territory. Mark Kirk inflated his Navy Reserve record to imply he saw combat, and Jerry Nadler claimed he was spit on returning from Vietnam despite never even serving in the military.
Which is just a huge risk.
It is. They take the risk of public humiliation because the political currency of having a hard past is just that valuable.
But, you know, the reason audiences demand that struggle, it isn't arbitrary. Think about it. If you pick up a novel and the protagonist grows up in a perfect family, has zero financial issues, and just lives happily ever after, what do you do?
You put the book down. It's boring.
You put it down. We are hardwired to respect the struggle. Heroes need something to overcome. And this actually connects perfectly to the mechanism Spurko uses to explain why overcoming matters. He uses this steel forging analogy.
Yes, the blacksmithing analogy is brilliant. We use the phrase forged in fire all the time, right? But the actual mechanics of blacksmithing explain the human psychology perfectly.
Break that down for us.
So blacksmithing is this 3,000 to 4,000-year-old process, and it requires three specific steps to turn raw iron into a usable blade. Step one is austenizing.
Okay.
You heat the steel to a critical temperature. And this isn't just to make it soft. It fundamentally changes the internal molecular structure of the metal.
Which, from my coaching perspective, is exactly what a traumatic or highly stressful event does to the human nervous system.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it fundamentally alters your internal baseline. Your whole system shifts.
Yeah.
But what happens next in the forging process?
Right, so step two is quenching. This is the rapid, violent cooling of that heated metal by plunging it into oil or water or brine.
The dramatic part.
Exactly. And what quenching does is freeze those molecules in a state of extreme high tension. It locks the new structure in place, so the metal is now incredibly hard.
Right. But there is a massive catch to that hardness.
Right.
When you quench steel, because those molecules are frozen in high tension, the blade becomes glass hard.
And glass hard is not a good thing for a tool.
No, it means it is incredibly brittle. If you take a quenched blade and drop it on the floor, it will literally shatter into pieces. And honestly, this is exactly what I see in my coaching practice with people who survive a trauma but never process it.
They get stuck in that brittle state.
Yes. They become highly defensive, which looks tough from the outside. They put up walls, they're aggressive. But internally, they're emotionally fragile. They're brittle. If life drops them, they shatter.
That is such a powerful parallel, which is exactly why a blacksmith never stops at quenching. They have to perform step three, which is tempering.
The most important part.
Yeah. They take that glass-hard, brittle blade, and they reheat it at a much lower controlled temperature for a long period. This process relieves the internal molecular stress.
So it softens it a bit.
Exactly. It trades a tiny bit of absolute hardness for a massive amount of toughness and resilience. After tempering, the blade will bend instead of breaking under pressure.
And that tempering process, that is the actual work of processing your past.
Right.
And, you know, while we just talked about people who fake their hardships, Spurko provides some undeniable examples of people who went through the fire, got quenched, and then put in the agonizing work to temper themselves.
Real verified hardship.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oprah Winfrey, right. She went from rural poverty and a deeply abusive home to becoming a media titan. Or J.K. Rowling. She was a single mother on welfare, writing in cafes just to keep the lights on.
And Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. He had exactly $7 to his name after his football career collapsed, and he used that absolute rock bottom to rebuild his entire persona.
And Neil Donald Walsh.
Oh, yeah. He went through medical bankruptcy, lost his home in a fire, and ended up living in a tent. I mean, he was homeless. And it was from that exact state of tempered despair that he wrote Conversations with God, which sat on the bestseller list for years.
Incredible. And what I appreciate is that Spurko applies this to himself, too.
He does, very candidly.
Yeah, he writes about coming from a hard past. He was the son of a coal miner. He has an estranged family. And he admits he still battles a quick temper because of that history. But his stance on it is really profound. He explicitly states he would not time travel to erase his difficult childhood.
From a historical and biographical perspective, that is the ultimate claiming of agency.
How so?
Well, if he traded his past for an idyllic, comfortable upbringing, the compounding interest of his life would be totally different. He wouldn't have built his podcast community. He wouldn't have the specific relationship he has with his wife, his son, or his grandkids.
Right.
He wouldn't be who he is becoming.
That word becoming, that is everything. And Spurko uses two case studies of everyday men in his own network to prove that this isn't just for billionaires or authors or celebrities.
Right, it's very applicable.
These are men who weaponize their hardship for growth. The first is John Wills. He runs SOE Tactical Gear. And John's story is intense. He took a felony plea deal to save an innocent family member from facing charges.
Wow.
Yeah. He served the time and walked out of prison with absolutely nothing except a sewing machine in his mom's garage.
And getting hired as a felon is notoriously difficult. I mean, the system is not built for that.
Not at all. So John had to build his own path. He begged former suppliers for fabric scraps. He worked pizza delivery jobs just to fund his material costs. And through sheer unrelenting hustle, he built a multi-million dollar tactical gear company in Tennessee.
That's amazing.
And he doesn't hide his past. He employs anyone willing to work hard. And if people complain to him about a lack of time, his famous response is, sleep faster.
I love that. Sleep faster. And the second example is Joel Riles, who owns Fortress K9. Joel had a really solid career as an army officer and a police officer, and he was building a high-end dog training business. But due to a vindictive ex-wife and an overzealous prosecutor, he was charged over a procedural error involving a tiny sliver of training explosive.
Just a technicality, basically.
Yeah, it wasn't a danger to anyone, but he ended up serving felony prison time. He lost his career, his freedom, his business. Everything.
He got dropped on the floor.
Exactly. But he didn't shatter. He came back, managed to get a couple of his dogs back, and rebuilt from scratch. Today, he breeds and trains advanced protection dogs that sell for tens of thousands of dollars.
And what really stands out to me about both John and Joel is the secondary effect of their tempering.
What do you mean?
Well, they didn't just build profitable businesses to insulate themselves from the world. As a coach, my biggest takeaway is that they both use their pasts as fuel to actively mentor and serve others.
Oh, that's a great point.
They didn't just survive the fire, they became the blacksmiths. They used the lessons of their worst days to help other people navigate their own crucibles.
Now, I can imagine someone listening to this and thinking, well, hold on. I had a pretty normal, safe, comfortable childhood. My parents loved me. We had enough money. Does that mean I lack an edge? Am I destined to be soft?
Right, like, do I need to go find some trauma?
Exactly. And Spurko addresses that exact fear by examining what he calls the privilege trap.
Yes, I am so glad he included this. Because having absolutely everything handed to you and being insulated from consequence, that is its own unique form of hardship.
It denies you the friction required for growth.
Exactly. Without friction, there is no traction. You just spin your wheels.
Historically speaking, the truly generationally wealthy families understand this concept implicitly. They know that comfort breeds fragility. So what do? They manufacture struggle.
Like the Bush family.
Yes. Spurko uses the example of former President George H.W. Bush. Despite immense family wealth, he sent his son George W. Bush to work as an oil roughneck.
Which is brutal work.
Spurko notes this specifically, drawing from his own family's background in coal mining. Being a roughneck is one of the most brutally dangerous, exhausting jobs on the planet. One lack of focus and you lose a limb. But the elder Bush knew his son needed to be tempered by genuine risk and hard labor.
Conversely, the people who often fall into the privilege trap are first or second generation upper middle class parents.
Oh, right, because they made it out.
Yeah, they worked incredibly hard to escape their own difficult pasts. And out of a deep sense of love, they want to give their children everything they never had. But by completely insulating their kids from real challenges, they deny them the courage that can only come from overcoming adversity.
Which brings us to a really crucial realization about history and biology. The exact same environment can produce radically different outcomes based entirely on the meaning assigned to the experience.
This part of the chapter hit hard.
It did. Spurko illustrates this with a poignant look at his own high school experience. He grew up in a poor county where almost everyone had similar struggles. Divorced parents, lack of money, limited opportunities. But the paths his peers took diverged wildly.
He contrasts two specific classmates to make this point, right?
Yeah. One had a broken home, but used that reality to fuel an intense work ethic. Today, he is a highly successful, famous graphic designer doing work for the MLB, the NBA, and the NFL.
Amazing. And the other.
The other was a smart, popular girl who shared the exact same kind of brokenness, specifically an absent father. But instead of accepting that reality and building from it, she became obsessed with a fantasy.
Rockstar fantasy.
Exactly. She convinced herself her father was a famous rock star and that if she could just find him, her life would be fixed.
And the absolute tragedy is that she did find him. He was living just 50 miles away.
And he wasn't a rock star.
No. I mean, he bought her a car and tried to make up for lost time, but external things cannot fix an internal narrative of victimhood. It didn't fix her internal pain, and she ultimately took her own life via heroin overdose.
It's a devastating story.
It is deeply devastating, and I have to be careful here because telling a grieving person to just use their trauma for growth borders on toxic positivity if it isn't handled with immense care. It is agonizing work.
Of course.
But the reality, Spurko points out, is that these two classmates had an identical brokenness in their pasts. The physical facts of their history were the same. But the meaning they assigned to it one choosing agency, the other choosing a fantasy of rescue that dictated survival versus destruction.
That tragic difference, why one thrived and one was destroyed by the exact same absent father, isn't just a matter of having a good attitude. It is deeply rooted in how we store and process memories.
Right, it's biological.
It is. And to explain this mechanism, Spirko uses a brilliant analogy comparing the human brain to a massive data center.
This analogy is a total game changer for understanding how to process history. Think about it. Your brain is running quadrillions of background processes per second. It dwarfs the scale and complexity of the most advanced AI data centers on Earth.
So imagine you are the CEO of a massive tech company. You spend billions of dollars building a state-of-the-art data center. You pay the astronomical electricity bills, you pay the property taxes, you hire the security and maintenance staff.
Sounds expensive.
Very. But then you just never use it. You let the servers sit there in the dark, processing absolutely nothing.
Your shareholders would mutiny. It would be an insane waste of capital.
Exactly. And Spirko argues that you paid for every single experience in your past with the most valuable capital in the universe, your time.
Wow.
You paid for every victory, every scar, every trauma, and every mistake with a piece of your finite life.
As he bluntly puts it, you started dying the moment you were born.
Cheerful thought. Right. But the point is, failing to extract actionable lessons from your past is exactly like letting a billion-dollar data center sit idle. You paid the massive cost to acquire the data, but you are refusing to run the analytics.
Which brings us to the central choice you have to make today. Are you going to treat your history like a rap sheet, or are you going to treat it like a training log?
A rap sheet versus a training log.
Yeah. And in my coaching practice, this specific shift changes everything. A rap sheet is a permanent list of convictions that condemn you. It's a liability that excuses why you are stuck. And honestly, when clients view their past as a rap sheet, their literal physical posture is slumped. They are defeated.
It weighs them down.
Literally. Mm-hmm. But a training log is entirely different. A training log is permanent equity. It is a record of heavyweights lifted, miles run, and injuries recovered from. It proves you can take hits and stay in the fight.
So it's proof of capability.
Yes. When a client shifts to viewing their past as a training log, their shoulders go back. They realize they possess an incredibly expensive, hard-won asset.
And to help you make that shift, to actually turn the training log concept into daily action, Spirko provides a highly practical framework in the chapter. He calls it the FORGE method, F-O-R-G-E.
Let's walk through the mechanics of why this works.
Okay, so F stands for face the truth.
This is huge. Facing the truth means you have to stop editing your story, you have to stop flattering yourself to look like the hero, and you also have to stop exaggerating the damage to excuse your inaction. Accuracy is your raw material. You cannot forge a strong blade if you are working with fiction.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Then O is own the results. Now, this is a crucial distinction. Ownership is not about taking the blame for things outside your control.
Like an abusive childhood.
Right, or a market collapse. Ownership is about claiming authority over what happens next. When you take ownership, you turn something that happened to you into something you can use.
I love that. And R is refine the lesson. This goes back to the tempering process we discussed earlier. It requires the discipline to strip away the blinding, heavy emotions of an event to find the utility underneath. The historical event is fixed. You can't change what happened, but the lesson you extract from it is entirely your choice.
Which leads right into G, which stands for grow the edge. This is where you turn your raw experience into actual capability. You let your failures harden your resolve without making you brittle.
And finally, E.
Yeah.
Execute forward. You have to apply the insight immediately because momentum only exists after you start moving. You cannot steer a parked car.
So true. So to distill the major themes of this chapter, hardship in its rawest form is inherently neutral.
Neutral, right.
You cannot change the physical facts of what happened to you. You only control the interpretation of those facts. And the stark warning here is that if you do not actively choose to turn your past into an asset, it will default to a liability.
It requires a deliberate, conscious rewriting of your internal operating system. And Spirko doesn't just leave us with theory here. He gives us the exact operating instructions to rewrite that mental code.
The coding language for the brain.
Exactly. He provides three specific sequences to run whenever the past tries to pull you backward. I want to read these exactly as he wrote them because the phrasing is very intentional.
Go for it.
First, computer. When regret for my past arises, run sequence. What can I do today to honor the lesson of yesterday's regret?
That reframes regret entirely.
It does. Second, computer, when faced with a hard choice, run query, What lessons does my past hold for me in this moment?
Using the data center.
Exactly. And third, computer, when I start leaning on past success for comfort, run audit, what am I building today that proves I'm still moving forward?
That is a powerful, systematic framework for reclaiming the narrative of your own history. For anyone wanting to dive deeper into these concepts, explore the Forge method in detail, and find more resources to build out systems for their own life, you can find more at jackslaws.com.
Absolutely. The tools to stop letting your past drag you like an anchor are all laid out in the book, and you can access more at jackslaws.com.
Before we go, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on the text we've unpacked today.
Lay it on us.
Imagine you woke up tomorrow morning with a completely blank slate. You have no memories of past pain, no trauma, no embarrassing failures. You are completely unburdened.
Sounds nice at first.
It does, but along with the pain, you also lost all the resilience, the grit, the empathy, and the hard-won wisdom you gained from surviving it. Looking at your own training log right now, which specific hard-won lesson would you be most terrified to lose?
Wow. That completely changes how you look at the receipt of your life, doesn't it? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Be sure to visit jackslaws.com, and we will see you next time.